All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, gorgeous.
Hi.
There she is.
Is that how you say it?
It is how you say it.
Yeah, you
said it right.
You're the first person to get her name right. And Lai has been everything. Lysol. Leroy. She's been everything to every guest.
Leia.
You guessed it on the... Princess Leia.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
This is going to be a good
episode. Hi, everybody.
Episode.
What's going on, Miss Melba?
Hello.
How are you?
We're alive and well. Good to be here.
Yeah.
Good to have you here.
Great to have you here, too. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Questlove, host of Questlove Supreme. What can I say? Well, first of all, Team Supremers, hello.
What up?
Hi, Maya and Steve and Ponticolo.
Yeah,
shout out to unpaid Bill somewhere, paying his bills. I got to say that this interview is a long time coming. Once again, I always say that we're honored to be in the presence of royalty, but this is definitely the case for that episode, for this episode. Melba Moore, you know, what can I say? Broadway actress. She was in the original
Hair.
The original Hair with Ronnie Dice. So many questions. She is a Tony Award winner for Pearlie. I even saw her in, y'all might not remember this, but in 78, Timbuktu was a big deal. I saw Timbuktu, her and Eartha Kitt, I think the first week it came out. My mom took me to see Timbuktu.
Oh.
Not to mention her music career, signed to Neil Bogart's legendary Buddha Records in the early 70s, soon to Epic Records, and then, of course, in the 80s, her legendary run on Capitol Records, having discovered and been involved in with so many greats, including one of our favorites, Freddie Jackson, managing his career, not to mention movies, just everything so legendary about this guest. Please welcome to our show, finally, Queen Melba Moore. Thank you.
Yes, yes.
Thank you so much, everybody. I am so excited to be here with you all. Well, how do you remember all that?
I'm a fan of yours.
I heard you was one of them geniuses. That's what I heard about.
No. I'm just
This is my
platform is nothing but just the having the best seat in the house and interviewing people that, you know, excite me. I guess I became friends with you because you would always come to are always on our DJ gigs. Your D Nice's DJ gigs of mine as well, and got to know you. I'm still do your jazz set one day. Actually, wait, I just did your jazz. Oh, dang, I forgot to tell you. I finally did your jazz set yesterday. You asked me to put a jazz set together, and
wow,
I finally got one together like last week. We shot this way later, but yes, I finally got one together.
Thank you.
So, how are you? Were you right? Are you still a New Yorker? Like, what part of the world are you in?
I'm I'm in West New York, New Jersey.
Okay. That part of New York, yes. The Jersey part, yes. I feel like everyone in Jersey.
Yeah.
True New Yorkers live in Jersey. I didn't get the memo.
Well, now listen, I blame North New Jersey, too.
Mm-hmm. Ah, wow.
Yeah. Okay. So where were you? Were you always in New York, or where were you born?
I was born in New York, yes.
Okay. What part?
Harlem Hospital.
Hey. Oh, okay. You're a Harlemite.
No, I lived on 108th Street. So it's like two blocks below Harlem. I'm always on the cusp of everything, okay?
Okay. Almost there, but not quite there. Okay. Yes. I see that. I guess in your, well, in your beginnings, what was your childhood into, at least musically? Did you grow up in a musical family? Were you, I know that your parents were also like singers as well. Like, what was your childhood like?
I have it in my genes. You might know who Teddy Hill is, do you, Quest?
I know this name.
It's way before your time. I don't mean that, but
yeah, no, I study.
I know you. You are walking encyclopedia, so you might know.
I know the name Teddy Hill, but I'm not familiar with all of his. So well, that's your father, correct?
He was a very famous big band leader. People like Dizzy Gillespie and those folks played in his band. Well, that's my natural father, but he didn't marry my mother. So my mother was a professional singer.
Mm. Okay.
Okay. So I started out with music in my blood, but, you know, estranged family. My grandmother had stroke, so she didn't speak. So I don't really know my family history. My mother's from Pipe Shop, Alabama. Didn't nobody ever hear that, right? Mm-hmm. You know about Birmingham, but you don't know about Pipe Shop.
Pipe Shop. Okay. Really?
Don't sound like I want to go.
Right. Everybody's from there.
Right.
They don't stay there.
They don't stay.
So I started out my life really with a disjointed, broken family like many African-American people did. But then my mother married my stepfather, who was a piano player, and they worked together. So when I moved to Newark, because he was from Newark, I then had a stepsister and a stepbrother. Later on, two more half-blood brothers. Mm-hmm. And daddy made us all take piano lessons. So that's when I found out I could sing. I was already 10 years old. I mean, when you're the instrument and you're born into it, you expect like you're going to start singing about 3 or 4 years old because the instrument is already there. So it really started late. That's my point, I guess I'm trying to make.
So for you, starting at that age was late to you and in your mind? Like,
well, I mean, usually when people have a voice, by the time they're 3 or 4 years old, they can sing.
Okay.
Is that what happened with your mom? Because y'all have similar voices in a way. I was listening to her.
Yeah.
Song.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess you said, Quest, you want to know what is your question, right?
No. I really want to know. I know that also in Newark, especially in that time period, the legacy that Newark had as far as its singers are concerned, I know that Sissy Houston was around there and at the time and the Warwick Sisters and whatnot. Like, as far as the musical richness of Newark, what was the environment like back then?
Well, there were lots of music bars, clubs with bands and combos. Later on, there were still continued to be, and people like Rhoda Scott and these great organ players were in these clubs all the time. Of course, we also had concerts, and it was just very, very rich. I mean, to the point, too, where by the time it was time for me to go to high school, I already decided. I didn't know if I could have any real talent, but I wanted to be involved. I wanted to be in music, so I went to music and art high school.
What high school was that?
Arts High.
Okay, so there was like a performing arts high school. Arts High School.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I see.
It's like a famous one, right? That's what I was about to...
It's not famous like the one in New York, but I can tell you people like Wayne Shorter went there.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was going to say, who else went there that was of note besides, well, Wayne Shorter was one of them. Anyone else?
Tons. I can't remember them all now, but tons and tons and tons of like ridiculously talented people.
Oh, okay. Like, who were your idols during that time period? Or like, at least what was the, who was the person that you looked up to the most?
Look, people like Bobby Timmons or Horace Silver. I thought I was going to be a piano player.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No.
Okay. That was your initial goal?
Yeah. Well, because my stepfather was a piano player, and he played really, really well, and he loved piano, and he made everybody around him just fall in love with it. So I thought I could do it too.
So then what was your first moment as in an entry into your professional, at least that moment where you knew that you were going to make this your life calling?
Well, after I spent about 2 or 3 years teaching vocal music in the public schools of Newark, I told my father, I said, this is your dream, Daddy. I do it really well, but I don't want to do it. Would you please introduce me to some of your people? See, can you get me into the industry as a performer? And if it doesn't work, I'll come back and teach school. So to make a long story a little bit shorter, one of the first people I met was Valerie Simpson. A music publisher's offered trying to sell her songs already from at the beginning of her life and career, because this was like late 60s. And we exchanged numbers, and she got me involved with studio background singing work and singing jingles. So that was my entry into the industry. I started, if you know Valerie Simpson, she's at the top of her chain. She started out at the top.
Right. Yes. Oh, wow. Yes.
Because she's just a genius. What am I going to tell you?
Motown. Yes.
Yeah.
So then would you say that acting, like, did that come into play before you became a singer? Like, was acting your first foray as far as, like, doing plays or whatnot?
Heck no.
No?
I didn't have a clue that would be in my future. But one of the recording sessions was being performed by Galt McDermott, who wrote the music for the book, Show and Hair. Mm-hmm. And they were still casting for it. And they told us if we wanted to cut any of us, they had really basically been auditioning us without us knowing it.
Right.
And if we wanted to, they would find a part for all of us in the show. If we would come down and sing for the director and the producer. I was the only one on the day. Cared about getting into theater. So I got into my first Broadway show that way.
So, okay, for our listeners that don't know. I was going to say, well, not only that, I know that Hair was just something out of nowhere and very, people think of Hair, at least everyone that I know that saw it in real time told me that basically that was the first time that, open front nudity was such a thing on Broadway. Like, how controversial was it then to get involved? How did they talk you guys into it?
We were in previews, and I don't know, someone from the production team came up with the idea and told us all we had to do the nude scene, and everybody threatened to quit because we didn't have that in mind, and it was shocking to us. But then when they made it kind of, well, if you want to do it, you can. If you don't, you don't have to. I was curious, so I did it.
Every night?
Well, I don't remember if I did it every night.
Right.
You can do it if you want to. You don't have to.
Can you take us through the Hair ride? Because I read, right, that you also replaced Diane Keaton, which was like the first time that a Black woman had ever done that in theater. But can you, what was your actual process in Hair in that way?
Okay. Well, what happened was I had been in the show for about a year, and they had a lot of different people coming in to do the lead role of Sheila, and they weren't happy with them, so they kept leaving. And so one of the black girls, said, how come y'all don't ever let a black girl try out for? Melba would be great at it. Why don't you let her?
Melba, why'd she throw you in there?
This same girl, she was very loud mouth, big mouth young lady. Matter of fact, one of the parodies that she played Abraham Lincoln, kind of singing like the Gettysburg address, but like in rap, like, happy birthday, baby, happy birthday to you. Or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Wow.
Very irreverent.
Wow. Yeah, we did a production of Hair when I was in high school. I played Hood. So.
Oh, okay. Yes. It was a male
lead.
Yes.
That's what I'm about to say.
Hell no. Nah. We weren't naked, man. We weren't doing that. But, it was a very toned down version, but, we did it. But, yeah.
So she pushed you in front of the bus, and then.
Well, what happens, I'd like to audition for it. So. They rehearsed me in the role, and a couple of different Saturday matinees, they let me get up and try out for them. That's how I got the role.
Was that your first play or?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I had no theater background.
Oh, really?
Wow.
You know, Black people, there's musical.
I mean, yeah, but.
I'm talking about back in the day, we were allowed to do anything, you know, now.
Yeah, yes.
Well, so many legends came from that production.
Yeah, that's true.
What was it like? Well, because I for a lot of my favorites that I grew up listening to when I was a kid in the 70s, like, you couldn't find out much about them. I mean, I've always heard about Ronnie Dyson and how incredible he was as a singer, but, you know, he really didn't get that much press.
No, no. There was no press for Black people during that time except Jet Magazine.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Besides Ronnie Dyson, was there anyone else notable that was in?
There were several. I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah, Ben Vereen. Wait a minute.
Wow.
Donna Summer.
Wow.
That's right. I forgot Donna Summer. Okay. Was it?
Yeah.
How long was it until Pearlie was immediately after or?
Immediately after. Immediately after. Because that same Big Mouth Black girl?
Yeah.
I can say her name is Mary Davis. I always remember Mary.
Mary.
She said, "Mommy, you've been in this play a long time. You need to start going up the thing." She said, "You don't even know how to audition. Why don't you just see if you can learn how to audition? You don't even know how to audition." And she told me about auditions for Pearlie. And she told me about how to do what they call typecasting. I said, "Well, Mary, what is that?" He said, "Well, you learn something about the character and you try to look at the character." And of course, the character was a backwoods illiterate maid. But that's who I was raised by, because I had what we called a governess or a nanny, because my mother was a single parent. She was gone. And she was a backwoods cotton chopper. So like most Americans, we have two countries that we identify as. And so country was mine.
Can you talk about those Pearlie days? I'm sorry, Amir, because I was just talking to my dad, who comes from New York around that time and used to party with y'all. You don't know him, that's fine. But he was saying that the parties around Pearlie and one of the lead dancers who had two homes, one for the artist, I think, and one for himself, was like just like you'd never seen before.
Pearlie.
The cast, cast parties and whatnot, and the good times.
Yeah, they were great. They really were.
And that's all you can
say.
It is all you can say, Carmel.
Well, no, I could say more, but perhaps I shouldn't.
Oh.
That means you should.
A lady.
Yeah, you know.
A lady don't say.
If you don't tell us, we'll never know the history is all.
Well, I'll tell you who was in the chorus, and he showed me like what the Tony Awards were about, and told me that I had, you know, have a formal gown with George Faison.
Yes, all your birthday is today.
You know him, you know he's crazy, right?
Yes, yes, love him. Yes, the choreographer of The Wiz, everybody. Yes.
Right, and Sherman Hemsley.
Oh, party.
Wow.
Sherman Hemsley was
in the
party. Oh, that's all you had to say. We already heard about Sherman. So.
Because, you know, he thought he was Carmen McRae, okay?
Daddy would have let
you
say that.
Wow.
He thought he was coming.
Yeah, that's how it was.
Oh my God, I love it. Sometimes y'all just seem so much more free than sometimes in here. We're just a little bit more uptight.
I didn't have a clue what I was doing, so I was free. You're talking about stage left, stage right. I said, but what is that?
your first audition, my second play.
So how shocked were you to get a Tony for Pearlie?
I seen it on tape, but I don't remember half of it because it was just too shocking.
Wow.
It's too shocking.
Let me see what you wore, because I know it was fierce.
I was in costume, because we performed.
Oh, that's right.
I remember the lights were on, because, you know, it was television.
Yeah.
So I could see Pearl Bailey and Rex Harrison and these people. But I don't know what I did. I didn't know where I was supposed to be or what the categories were. So I thought they had already called my category. And there was a gentleman, his name, an actor named Jack Jones. And he was doing a lot of the announcing and saying what categories. I was confused, but he was always drunk.
So you thought he had got it wrong? You thought he was drunk and called
the
name?
No, he did get it wrong.
What? Oh, wow.
Because he said somebody else's first name and my last name. And the whole audience started yelling, no, Nevermore, Nevermore. I said, oh, my God, what's going on? You know, it was shocking to me.
Are your parents still with us at this point when you win your Tony?
Yes.
What did they, what did they think?
Well, my dad was really glad that he didn't insist that I kept teaching school. I wasn't too happy about the nude scene and hair.
Oh, in that part.
But they were
so your parents were more like fall back on something that's secure and not. I was about to say, by this point, do you at least have like a manager? Are you like, okay, I'm going to go full throttle and.
No.
So you just like, oh, I got lucky. I got one play and then, I got in another play and I won this Tony. So
after that, I think I got an agent after that.
Okay.
Because then, you know, our television show came along. I was working at all the best supper clubs. Like the Palmer House in Chicago and the Waldorf Astoria in New York. And, you know, these, so they had to be negotiated. So I got an agent then.
So explain to us, like, exactly when you say a supper club, what was that type of entertainment venue like?
Beautiful, fancy club. Let me see. You know the City Wineries?
Yes, ma'am. Yep. Oh, okay. Yeah. City Winery. Yeah. We played City Winery before.
Something like that. Very classic, okay. Very, very. You know, and you have dinner, you have supper.
You have dinner, gotcha.
Yeah, and you'd have a big orchestra or a small ensemble, but the top entertainment.
Okay, got it.
And you wear a gown.
I was thinking of clothes.
Excuse me if you want to. I love this business. What can I tell you?
It loves you back.
Yeah.
So your recording career, I know that you got signed in 70s, but I made a mistake. Neil, Buddha wasn't your first label, right?
No, Mercury was, because I got that, I guess in the early 70s while I was still in Pearly. Yeah.
Okay.
That was my first.
I've looked what you're doing to the man. I think that was, 71?
Yeah.
71, 72.
Yeah. Because I got that as a result of Pearly. I got a recording offer as a lead singer, you know, as a solo artist for the first
time. So even then, it's not like by the time you get a record deal, surely by this point, you're a fully operational business. I should hope so.
Well, not if you don't know the business.
Right. How can one navigate without, at least in today's terms, you know, it's like, everything has to be in place, like your manager, your tour managers, your social media manager, your business manager, da, 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 da. But back then, it just, none of that ever occurred?
No, I think it was more structured then than it is now. You can almost be a one-man band now and, you know, do your own media. Because a lot of things that you can kind of outsource, I might call it. It was very kind of systematic, and especially being a Black woman, somebody had to go before you negotiate these things. I mean, the only reason I was even talked about being allowed into these venues was because it came through theater, which essentially was white. Not essentially, it was white. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember seeing Patti LaBelle on the Tonight Show, and they weren't going to let her sit down, but the people wouldn't let her go.
Wow.
Because it's, you know, systemic racism. So you had to have some kind of management team to carry out those. I mean, the office can't do it, but they had to go through somebody, you know?
Because that's funny, because I was sitting here thinking, like, but you came from a family full of musicians, but yet and still, they're Black musicians, so business was never right, so it's not like you could look to them and be like, well, what should I do when...
There's still a level of information that's withheld from us.
Yeah. Right, and then you're evolving, because you're in a place where they've never gone, and so it's like...
Precisely.
Right, that's ill.
The one album... In your arsenal that I'm fond of is Peach Melba, which came out in 75. First of all, before I ask you anything, I gotta know, during the height of Lean on Me itis, and not Bill Withers Lean on Me, but Melba Moore's Lean on Me. If you were alive and aware at the time when the song was at its height in the 70s, most people will know that you hold a note for at least a good 30 seconds. I'll say longer than Bill Withers singing Day on Lovely Day.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and I used to actually try to, and you would do this song often. I've seen you do it on The Tonight Show. I've seen you, even when you did it live, you held the note longer. And I just never knew a person that could hold one note for like almost 50 seconds. Did you regret having to do that every time? Like, I almost felt like it was its own Olympic competition, like the duration of holding that note. Like,
it was fun, and for me it was an athletic activity. It was something that was, it wasn't always there. Everything that I'm able to do, it seemed like I had to work 25 times harder than other singers. I had to go jump rope, boat swim, dog, you know, and do my vocal research, study, holler and scream and yell and everything. And then after a while, the stamina grew to the point where one day, I remember I was singing this song, Climb Every Mountain, for some little group in a nursing home or somewhere, I don't know.
Right.
And I took one big, big, big breath and I said, you know, let it out. And it kind of went over across the room, you know, traveled. Uh-huh. And I was strong enough so that I was sitting, standing there holding it, but I wasn't so conscious that I was doing it. And I said, well, wait a minute, that's me. So I kept holding it. I said, well, I wonder if I could always do that. And then I started to develop stamina to do it. And it's just become something that I'm so grateful for and happy about. And now I understand, like, well, I can't eat everything and do this. That's why what I call an athletic activity. Now, I can't go and have no Jack Daniels. I can't have no fried chicken.
What?
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte Gallo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty: Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So what is your regimen as far as keeping your muscle intact? Because again, to hold it for that strong and that much vibrato over 40 seconds is not normal. I thought it was some Kenny G cheating method where you do the wrong breathing.
No, somebody says circular breathing. I said, I'm not a horn.
Yeah, I thought you were circular breathing because, you know. Wait on me. And what do you yell at the end of the song?
Oh, that was a tough.
Shaz Bosner! Like, what are you talking in tongues? Like, what's.
Of course.
Okay. I never knew what you yelled at the end of
that. Yeah,
that
was a whole topic. On I forget what show we were doing, but we talked about that. So
yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
I think the last times that I've been doing it is it's evolved into make it, so it's make it come.
Make it down. Okay. When you're a 5-year-old, listen to that. I thought you were doing some sort of taekwondo I never heard of before.
I do want to hear the answer to that question, though, because you never. What is your prep when it comes to your voice?
A lot of baked chicken, or lean protein. I know you think chicken is a gospel bird, but it is.
Yes.
What? Because I just thought you were going to say no dairy or okay.
Well, no dairy. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no fried foods, no oil,
not a coconut.
A lot of fish, vegetables. But then I got to work out, and I think the swimming helped. I've always loved swimming, and I thought I was a Scorpio water sign. It's not, is it?
No,
Scorpio is that water sign.
No, they walking on the desert. So they.
Well, I be walking too. I'm in mountains. Yeah. Aerobic exercises, thing that make you breathe hard. Mm-hmm. You build up the lung capacity.
Mm. I was curious to know the producer for Peach Melba was Eugene McDaniels, and to hip hop to my generation, he means something totally different. But what was it like working with him? I've never really heard stories of what he was like in the studio and his creative process. What was that like?
I went and stayed with him and his wife at his home.
Oh, wow.
Up in the California hills. And so I'm very, I'm affected by my environment. And he lived way up in, air was probably thin, so I was affected. I sound, to me on that Peach Melba album, I sound different. Or like I'm in another zone. Mm-hmm. That's how Gene McDaniels to me is like that.
Were you aware of his at least at the time in 75, his controversial political
heroes.
Yeah, like stance with the government. I know that the story was that when his second album came out, Headless Heroes of the Apocalypse, Spiro Agnew kind of placed a call to Ahmet Erdogan and kind of had him blackballed. Had his musicians' union card revoked. And so thus he was kind of left to make a living as a singer-songwriter. So thus he worked on your record, Roberta Flack, Blue Lights in the Basement. Like,
that's the time. What did he lean on the side of, Amir? What did he lean on the side of? Was he the big C word? Or?
Well, no. Not even that. I think it was rare for an artist to just, the way that we call out the government now on Twitter
and that Instagram. Didn't happen back.
Right. Okay.
Like his albums were Twitter. You just didn't hear of black people like just blatantly call the government's, liars or any of that stuff. And he had it in for Nixon to the point that, the Nixon administration just did all they could to silence him. And he couldn't. He lost his record deal. So, if he didn't write, that's the time I feel like making love to you, then that would have been, curtains for him.
Wow.
But, he produced people in the meantime, they couldn't stop him from producing other people. So I just wanted to know, like, just as a human being, like, was he kind of bitter what the government was doing to him, or he just
Heard him speak anything about his politics. That's why I thought he was kind of, you know, kind of up in ethereal like me. Sweet and gentle and
okay.
And, you know, but he was I didn't know anything about his politics. First time actually I've heard of it.
Okay. Yeah. So were you aware that at the time when you made the record, did you meet the kids that did Sunshine Superman with you?
No, I didn't.
I'm certain that people have reminded you that Wendy Melvoin of Wendy and Lisa, Prince and the Revolution.
The Revolution, yeah.
And her twin sister, Susanna, were the background singers on Sunshine Superman. So
I probably knew it around that time, but I don't remember hearing about
it. Oh, you didn't know
it
at the time? Oh, okay. No. I see. You also, well, at least two albums later, you worked with Van McCoy. I know he produced the This Is It record. What was that like?
He put me in disco.
I was going to say, how can you describe what it's like to every artist I see that was recording in the 70s? Disco was more like a kind of like that Film and Louise mountain jump. Like, can we make it to the other side, or are we going to fall underground? Like, what were your thoughts on conquering that? And, you know, I know Neil Bogart was your president at the time at Buddha. Like, what was he like as a, not much is said about Neil Bogart's time at Buddha and at Casablanca. I know that a lot of his artists were, like, you know, colorful, and he really, I guess you could say he was like the original Diddy, almost to the point where he was just as famous as his artists were.
As his label, yeah.
Yeah, what was he like as a...
I met him, I knew who he was, and he was very, very famous, but I really didn't have an awful lot to do with it because by that time I had good management. So they were the ones that actually went out and got Van, and they and the label got Van McCoy for me. Mm-hmm. And put us together. Then he and I, you know, worked on what we were going to do and try to establish me as a recording artist and help me develop a style and, you know, an identity. I didn't have help. Yes, I did. I had the note then. I did, yeah. What I was interested in Van McCoy for, I mean, he gave me This Is It, which put me into the disco or the dance genre, but right. I knew he had written Lean On Me.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And the reason
he wrote Lean On Me?
Yeah.
That's so weird. I can't imagine Van McCoy writing any non-up-tempo.
He wrote lots of ballads. He's a very prolific songwriter.
So that's how it reached you?
Well, no.
Oh, well, tell me.
Yes, but no. I had heard my favorite artist, Miss Aretha Franklin, singing. And I knew I couldn't sing like her, but the lyrics and everything just moved me so much, I started singing it. So I developed my own little arrangement of it with the long note. And I think the long note came in there because I was just so excited and so trying so hard to express something. Mm-hmm. And then once it had presented itself, and I... came in contact and touch with Finn McCoy. I made him do my arrangement of Lean On Me.
Gotcha. Okay.
Dope.
You also worked with McFadden and Whitehead. I'm a Philadelphian, so like any of those guys that are in the arsenal of under the umbrella of Gamble and Huff and Dexter Wanzel and, you know, Tom Moulton, like all those guys under the Philly umbrella. What was it? What was it like working with McFadden and Whitehead?
Let me see. Well,
they produced the Portrait of Melba album.
I told you what it was like working with Sherman Hemsley, right?
Yes, you did. Oh, kind of. Well, you kind of did, but you didn't.
It was like that.
Yes. Oh, good times.
They were crazy.
It was crazy.
I've heard stories.
Especially John Whitehead.
Really?
Wow, Philly dudes.
I mean, if he walked down the street, strange things happened.
How strange. Did you record that album in Philadelphia, or was it recorded in New York?
In New York.
Okay.
We kind of stole them from Philly International. Oh. Matter of fact, we were managing, our company, Hush Production, were managing Gene and John. And so we were the ones that produced them or managed them to do Ain't No Stopping Us Now. It wasn't Philly International.
You better tell that story.
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, you can't just casually, like...
You better tell it, Miss Moore.
Yeah. We kind of borrowed them.
So you're saying Hush Production started in 1976?
Well, you remember the years.
Well,
yeah,
I do.
You haven't been around that time. Yeah, that'd have been around
well,
that time.
I only started hearing of the term Hush Productions closer to like your Capitol work, but I never knew when it started. So you and your husband got into management.
Have a manager because I didn't have a manager still yet. At a certain point, I had an agent, but by that time, I had already lost my career for the first time.
By this point?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's unusual for an artist to start a manager. At least you don't hear of that in the 70s. Like, it was like a separation of church and states. Like, artists were artists and CEOs were CEOs. So what?
Right. That was the case with me. But my then husband was a gifted business person. And when we met, we tried to find a manager for me, but everybody told me, well, she's Broadway. She can't do this. She can't do that. I started in the record industry as a backup singer. But so my point is that everything that they said I couldn't do, I had already done. So instead of having a stable of artists, we started a stable of managers.
Brilliant.
Oh, okay.
So once we got me started, then we got Freddie and Kashif and, you know, a whole bunch of people.
I was wondering what your roster looked like. Can you brag some more? Who else was on the roster? Did she?
Let me see. Melissa Morgan, Lilo.
Yeah, Melissa Morgan, yeah.
All the Capitol. Bo Huggins. I remember Bo Huggins. I remember
Orpheus. I remember, was that you guys?
Orpheus. Yep. Yeah, was a record company.
That was the label.
Did you mention Lilo? Lilo Thomas?
Lilo.
Mm-hmm, she did.
Paul
Lawrence. Huh? Said a Force MDs?
Force MDs.
And Paul Lawrence, too?
Paul Lawrence. Everybody from the 80s.
Freebasing was not yours.
Now I see how that Freedom Rain came together. Yeah. Okay, we'll get to that later, but still, yes. Yeah. Okay.
I had some music, I bet you, then.
What was Kashif like? He was always one of those guys that I just really, you know, admired. And, you know, I had a music class in college and they made us read like his book, you know, Everything You Need to Know About the Business. And
genius. He was just,
yeah. What was he like as a person?
We became, his daughter and his wife and I became real good friends because we put a recording studio in our little building at 231 West 58th Street. Mm-hmm. And when Kashif would come, he would record the stuff in our studio. Well, you said, what was he like? Mm-hmm. Well, he was like a vocal coach.
Mm, okay.
And the way he stacked the background voices, they're almost like you take individual sounds and singers and you put them in different places, not like a background. Mm-hmm. But he structured everything. And he was... I guess a perfectionist. We'll go over one phrase all day till y'all got it. I said, well, good. I'm going to get this. I'm going to learn how to sing. I bet you. I'm going to have me a hit record. Oh, it's fine with me. You know, I'm a student. I'm a teacher. So they're going to have patience with me till I get it.
So you're not one of those singers that is like, okay, three takes and I feel like it's enough. So let's move on. And
no, the more I do it, the better I get.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah. Under that production unit, so you guys managed Kashif. Did you guys also manage like there was Ronnie Harris as well.
Yeah, we managed Ronnie.
Yeah, Ronnie Harris, like a bunch of like tri-state guys that I know that were kind of under the Were they under like Kashif's tutelage, or because he had a very
Ronnie was his own entity. It was like parallel, another another Kashif.
I see. For me, especially the about to say somewhere over the Other Side of the Rainbow album. That's probably one of my favorite.
Yeah,
records.
That was the one. My aunt used to play that record all the time. I think I was like three when that came out. But
I'm
remember.
Sorry.
Oh no, you got to apologize. Wait, yeah, well, Jimmy.
Now the one with the art is you're thinking of Melba.
I was thinking Soul Exposed. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Did you specifically work with? I just have one question about the 78 record. Because I knew you did a cover of "You Stepped Into My Life." Did the Bee Gees specifically write that for you, or
you stepped?
The Bee Gees wrote that for you.
No, that was that album was it? All those songs like from Saturday.
She might. I think Yvonne Elliman might have done it. Someone else did it, but I didn't know who did it first.
Bee Gees did it first.
Okay, I see.
And do you get anything every time D Nice plays that record? Because he plays that record, and I hear it in my dreams.
Thank you.
Yes, he does, child. It's like a new record. I love it. I'm just.
D Nice and all you DJs, you know, make us relevant.
Yeah. Rich. Yeah. It's dope. Good. That's what we were hoping that you was. Okay, good. So it does matter. It does matter. Okay.
Absolutely. Because, you know, God keeps doing it. My daughter told me don't get too religious.
it's all good.
Do what you feel. Go there.
God keeps doing, you know, new things at least every decade or so. And he changes it. And so you've got to change the context. You got to change the neighborhood. I can't do that. I'm not even a songwriter.
Ooh.
Like your DJs, first of all, y'all used to just spin records. Now that's grown into their songwriters, producers. You promote shows. You created a genre. So you have some autonomy. You have some authority. Mm. And you have created a community of DJs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it's all black, but
the best ones are.
It's sweet. So we have some place to be.
Yeah.
You know, like in the early days, like especially since of somebody like me, my opportunities came through theater. So racist, but what they try to get you to do and you wanted to do was a crossover. But if you do that, you leave your community.
Right.
And they try to convince you, you don't belong here. You don't belong there. Well, it was too late, thank God, for that, to be convinced of that. So then, you know, we try to get a manager, and like when we couldn't do it, then we said, okay, well, why don't we try this? You've done theater, you've done TV, you've done this. So we got somebody from each of those areas. And, and then we said, okay, what kind of music are we going to do? So, and like I said, my then husband is gifted at business. So nobody taught him business, but he learned it, just like many of us Afrocentric people. Mm-hmm. You didn't get a chance to go get taught it. Then you learn it some kind of way. You learn it. You know, you have to learn how things go and create a space for yourself. And, you know, they call it R&B, put you in the back or in the corner, and that turns out to be the foundation of American music skills. Anyway, that's my humble opinion.
You're right.
Now, don't be humble about it. It's the truth.
There's one question I missed before we skip to Kashif. I always wanted to know this. So you worked with another legendary producer, Peter Pete
Bilotti.
Yeah. I guess. I'd like to know at least what was the decision in getting him. Pete Bilotti did like a lot of his music, like between him and Giorgio Moroder, like those guys were like
Italian
into
disco.
Like future electronic. Past that, I mean, what we now know is like electronica music.
Right.
Like those guys were pushing. Well, they were German producers, so sort of in line of what Kraftwerk was doing and all that stuff. What was it like working with him? Was the decision to sort of go into sort of like a futuristic dance mode, or like what was it like working with him?
Well, yes, because we were trying to stay current. And once again, like I said, my then husband went out and found the songwriters and producers who were relevant for the time and seeing where things were going and could we fit into it. They decided they would work with me. And so I co-wrote a lot of the songs that we did together. Because my then husband told me I should learn how to write.
Yes.
I just auditioned.
Yes. Get your money out. Yes. Yeah.
The money's in the parentheses.
Yeah. That's he was trying to teach me that. Yeah.
So did you, I felt like you made the transition to the 80s. It was, for a lot of artists, it was hard transitioning to the 80s. But of course, with, you know, with your work with Paul Lawrence and Kashif and all those cats, those New York cats or Jersey, New York cats. Just what was the environment like at the time? Because also like, you know, there's Lala, there's like so many of these greats that are in the what R&B was at the time. What I say is with at least the style of Kashif was him being kind of instrumental in the sound of Boogie, which is, you know, post disco, kind of the sound that Leon Silvers ushered in, like that Boogie sound. Could you explain what the environment in the early 80s was like in New York as far as like that whole crew's concerned, Freddie Jackson, Lala, like all those people?
Oh, well, of course, I may be, you know, inarticulate in actually describing, but it was so much fun. It was so musical. It was like you were exploring a place where everything functioned and worked, probably because we were in charge. And you could negotiate with the record company. I didn't, but my then husband did. He was good at it. So we were touring, we were sending up and coming artists. So it was always fresh sounds. And I mean, I'm a musician. So I mean, that was like being in heaven. Mm-hmm. We had fun. We liked each other. You know, we didn't have no problems. It was great. And then, you know, there was no lack of money or work. It was wonderful. I was happy that my baby was, you know, I was a new mother. I'm glad to tell you.
Jeez. Is your former husband, he's still alive? Him and his brother, yes. they're still alive?
Yes.
Okay, are y'all on good terms or how is it, that yes. relationship now? Y'all good?
Yes, yes.
That's what's up. That's what's up.
We're family. Hate to get religious, but God creates us. So I want to, you know, suck up to the boss.
Hey, I hear you.
I see.
And our daughter is happy and, you know, coming into her own. So,
yeah. You got an 80s baby, it sounds like. Okay. Yeah.
What was the story in developing Freddie Jackson? Like, I feel like of your stage, like, he was definitely your breakout artist. Like, how did you discover him?
Yeah. I told you about Sherman Hemsley, right?
Yes, I know. I already know. I didn't been around Freddie.
Freddie thought he was Sherman, too.
Yes, a party everywhere.
Wow.
That's how it was. I remember one time we were in the studio and he was going to come around to my house, you know, for a break, just, you know, chill a little bit. So I got dressed up. I forgot what I had on, but I had to get him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Show out.
So I opened the door and it was so, he was so shocked. He fell down on the hallway floor laughing. I said, now.
What was the outfit? Do you remember?
I forgot. It was some crazy something. I don't know.
I know.
Nobody else would see this, but you know, him and me. You know.
Where's Freddie Jackson from?
He's from New York.
Too, right?
Yeah. Of course. Oh, that's too much. Okay. All right.
But he likes to keep it in joke. He's a joker. He could probably do stand-up if he wanted to. That's his real personality. He's always laughing. And of course, you know, he could sing anything he can hear.
Right.
So wait, I'm going to ask, can I just ask a question that some of the 80s babies might want to know? I'm sorry. I don't know if this is touchy, but
sure.
Were he and Luther
I knew you were going to ask this question.
Or was there beef?
Oh.
Because we grew up thinking it was beef.
I was going to say, like, in my mind, I felt like there's some Pac Biggie. tension going on. Like, who's going to be the king of the hill?
I don't think they were friends, but I think it was just like a lively, friendly competition, especially on Freddie's part. Mm. Because Luther was the man. Luther is the man.
Yeah.
I mean, he has his own spot.
Yeah, true that.
So I'm sure everybody would want to aspire to that. But that's just my humble opinion because I don't really know.
What was the relationship like with Hush and Capital? I remember I was watching, years back, I think I was watching Freddie's Unsung, and he was talking about how his records were like going crazy and the people at Capital didn't, they had no idea. Like they didn't even, they were just so unaware of what was going on in black music at that time that when his record kind of took off, it, you know.
Well, they weren't prepared for it.
Yeah, they weren't prepared.
It wasn't only what was going on in black music. Our company became really an adjunct to the record company. We were the ones that started street promotions with the posters.
Gotcha.
And actually working your own record in your own areas and hiring your own marketing people and your own sales people.
Gotcha.
So of course,
your own street team.
You know, what are you going to say when we give you a hit?
Do you find that it's harder to be both artist and artist manager?
Yes, I
because I know it involves a lot of babysitting and Jedi mind tricks and.
Yeah, but you know what? I think I'm naturally a mentor, so I can't manage. That's a whole skill that I don't really have, and I don't think I have a real great interest in it. But I'm always interested in showing you and opening the way. Like for instance. We took Freddie on the road with me and he was my opening act. I didn't let him open for me. I put him in the middle of my show, introduced people to him and said to him, as soon as he starts singing, y'all going to start screaming. So I'm going to tell you who he is now. His name is Freddie Dex. Put him in the middle of my show instead of trying to make him bear all that pressure when you're first trying to get out there.
Yeah.
So I'm naturally a mentor. I'm not a manager.
Nah, and that is a difference. There's a distinction. I understand exactly what you mean. That makes sense.
Have a lot of other singers been coming to you for like mentorship throughout the years? I was curious about that, especially with all with the voice stuff.
Well, I think they didn't come to me because, you know, I have a team of people and they deal with everything. And so they don't come to me. But whenever I have an opportunity, and thank God people are interested on interviews, people want to know, well, how do you do this? And what would you tell somebody else? And so in that way, I can offer, you know, information or suggestions.
Even better.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned Melissa Morgan was also part of that stable, correct?
Yeah.
I'm just asking because, again, like, there's just a period between 82 to probably 92 of a bunch of artists that, you know, there wasn't social media out back then. There wasn't anything.
Right, right.
Unless they were in Jet, Soul Train, or Ride On Magazine, you really didn't know, or Ebony, you really didn't know about them. What was Melissa like in working? How did she become part of the stable?
Once again, Hush signed her as an artist. Mm-hmm. And so their relationship with her was with her. But Melissa and I have become friends.
Okay.
And what can I say? She likes me.
How could you not?
So, I mean, when I've had difficult times, she's like, "Well, Melba, do you need a ride?
Wow.
Can I help you? You know, where are you going?" You know, she'll probably find out and see how I am or whatever. We've just been friends, you know. And we've done some shows together now that I have another manager. And, you know, can do shows ourselves and say who we want to be with. We often work together. We've been in UK a lot, you know.
Oh, dope.
In, you know, when the iron was hot, in that period in the 80s, did you think about making a return to the other arenas that you were in as far as like your acting and plays and whatnot?
Well, yes, I made my then husband put Pearlie on videotape.
Okay.
Well, only thing I've seen on video, I'm sure the others, it's Hamilton since then, because it's still not a common thing for people to do.
Oh, okay. So that was unusual back then. Wait, were you involved with what was your involvement in, all right, this is a deep one. Are you guys familiar with Death by Temptation?
Yes, I was.
Remind me.
Temptation. All Over You by Freddie Jackson.
Yes, that was a joint.
But it was the joint with Kadeem Hardison and Bill Nunn.
Yes.
And James Bond the Third.
James Bond the Third, yeah.
Bond the Third. Right, he created that.
Yes.
Oh, wait, he created Death by Temptation. Okay.
Yes, he wrote and produced that. Well, we produced it. Hutch produced it.
Were you the producer of the film as well? Or
yes.
Okay.
You know, what was that like stepping into film and like producing your own film? That's a lot.
We would rent
that because we started to learn how to try to promote it and get it in theaters. And so I started to get into that. But my whole relationship with my then husband and Hush Production broke down shortly after that. So,
oh, man. What led to the breakdown, in your opinion?
I don't think I should say.
Not with the daughter sitting there. She like, mama.
Not today.
Not today.
Okay.
I'm good.
I love you, Lion.
I can already hear and feel. Let me ask, because we in the 90s now, but...
But not only that, you know, we're coming back trying to be mend our ways and...
And be better, yeah.
Yeah, and move
and heal.
On.
No need to revisit.
And it's such a different place now, and I think because of COVID and everything around the world stopping, we do have a chance to start over, and maybe the playing field will never be even, but we've all grown so much. We have a chance to try to start over, so we're trying to really do that.
That's real. That's facts.
But that period is when you credit, like, things went bad, and then, because I think you said something early on where you were like, my career fell down or something like that, and then you said that was the first time. So you can reckon, right?
That was before. This time we're talking about now.
Oh, okay. Okay, all right. Well,
one thing I've gotten very good at is falling and getting back up.
Well, speaking of that, that's inspirational. Yeah,
it is. It is.
Like,
but you got to work out. See, you got to be.
Nah, you look amazing. Like, you've really.
Yeah, I wasn't going to be in your business, but I was about to ask about your moisturizer. I was. Not sure. Because you said you don't eat no fried. I was like, is that not the fried foods? If I didn't eat fried foods, is that what I would end up looking like?
Is that okay
with
you?
Like you did when you were 20-something?
Yes. Okay, can she answer that, daughter?
Yes. She says yes.
Okay, I'm waiting.
Well, you know, massages and heat and nice creams and stuff, you know, and masks and and exercise the face and exorcise, you know, like exorcism.
Yes. Because my mother always said you're supposed to do E-I-O and all of this.
Oh, you have to exercise it. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
People don't know that. Okay, so.
Oh, that's real?
Yeah. Like, Amir, you got to. So, you know, black don't crack, but it can rust. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you got to take away the little crumbs of rust sometime, you know.
Mm-hmm. But can we talk about 1987? Because is that when Les Mis? When did Les Mis?
Yes. No. Les Mis was, I thought it was later.
Was it later?
I think it was later because.
Or 90, 1990.
Well, it was around that time or a little mm-hmm. bit later because that's the time then I lost my family and Hush and all of that. And I really was homeless.
Oh, wow.
But you all ever heard of Michael Matthews?
Michael Matthews.
Oh, you look so quizzical.
Because we want to know.
Educators.
Well, he created the gospel musical that Tyler Perry has taken to the lengths that he has.
Oh, okay.
The first one that Tyler did?
No. Oh. Michael Matthews did the first
one. Okay, that's what I'm... Okay.
The very first gospel. Okay.
Gospel play.
He pioneered
the gospel play.
Yes, he pioneered it. And what he did was he went to the churches around the major cities that had black populations. And he sold to them. So that's why we have gospel plays, because they're from the audiences were the church. And so by the time I met Michael, I was just about to be evicted. My daughter had run away. I didn't know where she was because of all the trouble that was going on. Hmm. I found out that I was divorced and had to go figure out all that stuff. But Michael had called me and invited me to come out to St. Louis. I think it was. He was doing one of his plays. And it's this huge, like 2,000-seater, 3,000-seater theater. And it was jam-packed. No, none of the black people knew his churches. So he figured out how to market the churches mm-hmm. and fill them up every day of the week.
Oh.
And so what he did then, he said these incredible actors and singers that he had put into the shows and musicians. That's where Mary and Mary came from.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Now, you know they're bad, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Why? And the one of them that's married to the piano player. He was a piano player from
Warren. Not Warren Campbell.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah, Baby Doug, Warren Campbell.
But to give you an idea of the quality of the music and what we were doing, what was raw. And I came out to start. He was bringing stars into those incredible companies,
which mm-hmm. they do. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So actually, that's how I really began to learn how to sing gospel because I'm Catholic.
But, oh. But opera, though.
Well, no, I sing opera. I was born doing that. But I had to learn how to sing gospel.
Wow. Okay.
Wow. Verse.
Wow.
Reverse it.
What was the question?
Oh, I was asking about Les Mis, but
okay. So so I was telling you about that, but then I didn't have anything, so I was trying to write a play where I could be the star so I could get up and get some work. But Richard J. Alexander, who casts Les Miserables, was in this little town called Hollywood, Florida. He came to see my play. And he didn't know I could sing classical music because you don't sing classical in Pearly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You would be great for Les Miserables. That's how I got it.
Man.
You know, you mentioned something earlier that I wanted to ask. So, you know, in 2020, a lot of people in our profession in entertainment, especially in March, I'm one of them, was definitely panicking. Because, you know, a lot of artists didn't know if they were coming or going, you know, this is how I make my living. And, you know, that, so I personally went through about a good 6 to 7 weeks of just straight up like panicking. I'm about to lose everything. I will say that it takes a steady mind to navigate, yourself out of that situation. How were you able to, the first time around when, you were about to lose everything and sort of not knowing where your career was going to go. Like, what, how was your mind state in that keeping slow and steady to get to a greener pasture, if you will, or a safer space that you could still be in? And like, how were you able to mentally overcome that?
I don't think I overcame it. I don't think I was calm and settled. I was depressed. Mm. I was oppressed, repressed. I was desperate.
Yeah, but I believe you overcame it because you're here speaking with us right now. And you were, you know.
Yeah.
So, but just at the time, what I was saying was that after 2 months of just, oh man, I'm going to die, I'm going to lose everything, Then I just had to stop, sit silent, and restart all over again.
Like, you have to. You have to. There's really nothing else you can do. But I'll tell you, the part of, I've always had help from people who came to my aid, even going through the Grand Sister Station, people giving me money. I mean, I was embarrassed and ashamed because they knew my story, but people came to my aid. And one of the things I guess is outstanding for me about going on the road with Michael Matthews and the gospel shows is they really were saved people. All they did, that's how I found out I was saved. Mm-hmm. He invited me to come out on a road, but all, right. I remember the first rehearsal. What's Deacon's last name, Kelly? Jackson. She's, good morning, saints. Praise the Lord, everybody. I said, oh my God, I thought I'd die because everybody around me was always cussing, you know? I said, oh. And, you know, and Michael, they would pray beforehand. And sometimes I would be just so broken. I'm sure I didn't cry or anything because I was too numb. I would just sit there. But there was somebody would come and sit by me, maybe come to my room and just be with me. You don't have to talk. And I know I was spiritually oriented, but to be dropped into that, then you kind of discover what's going on and what is saving you. And you know Charlie Wilson, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Yes, well, absolutely.
His brother Ronnie Wilson was on the road. And we used to call him Elder Bishop.
Oh, wow.
He's hilarious. But they're saved people. This is what they do. This is how they live. Hmm. And of course, all the shows were about family in different situations. Some of them kind of raw, but the whole point was you need Jesus.
Hmm.
But that's really what I am and who I am.
Hmm.
What happens is I can go back and tell you some of these incidences that it never occurred to me to do anything harmful to myself, but I was numb. I couldn't think or figure anything. But someone always came and said, well, what about this? Well, how about this? Well, you need this, you know, or like Michael didn't know what was going on with me. But as it turned out, that's why I know there's, you know, no coincidences or accidents. Mm-hmm. He put me on the road with him just when I was going to get evicted. And I had filed bankruptcy, so I didn't even have a bank account. But he paid me $7,000 cash every week. My only problem was how was I going to carry it in the paper bag, especially with all them singles.
Wow.
But that's the truth. You know, wow. It was my first time going on a tour, any kind of a tour. So you're riding along the highway in these big, travel tour buses. Mm-hmm. And the bus driver, he prays before we go. No, I'm just serious about it. And just an amazing presence. I can only say it's the presence of God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, however you can describe it, or I'm not so good at describing it all the time, but I know you just are in, you're not by yourself. You might think you are.
No, I feel it.
But you're not.
Actually, speaking of which, I totally forgot to mention, we should note that you were part of the ensemble cast of the Fighting Temptations.
Yes, you were.
That's a gospel show.
I totally forgot about that. What was it like doing that production?
Beyonce and Cuba Gooding Jr., right? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Cuba Gooding, Mike Epps.
First of all, I wasn't going to
The OJs.
The OJs, Mike Epps.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Several wonderful, all of them wonderful experiences, but I wasn't going to the movies or watching movies on TV, so I didn't know that Cuba Gooding Jr. was an acrobat. He was a choreographer. And he stood flat-footed and did a back overflip.
I wouldn't. Nobody knew that. No, you okay?
Nah, we didn't know.
Wait, you didn't know that? Cuba? Y'all don't know about Cuba's history?
He's a real acrobat. You mean that?
Yeah,
I thought y'all meant he could do flips.
No. Yeah.
He was training to be in the Olympics. Like he.
No.
If you look, oh God, I'm really dating myself here. Lionel Richie closed the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. And Cuba Gooding Jr. was sort of like the Alfonso Ribeiro of Lionel Richie's Michael Jackson at the closing ceremonies for the Olympics.
Wow.
Like tumbling and breakdancing and all that stuff.
Wow. So, I did not know that.
Dude, I'm telling you, we have to get Cuba on the show because
he's amazing.
Yeah, he's a nice man.
He's the craziest story I've ever heard in my life. He's one of the most interesting people I know. It's like
Cuba. And I'm saying to you too that you know they were nice people. And I would say about Beyonce, she made everybody look short and ugly.
Wow.
Well, what you gonna do?
But I remember the last song when the credits are coming down. She and Angie Stone and I are strutting down the runway. You know, doing our song. I'm acting like I could dance if I wanted to. No, but it was so fun. Do you remember the opening song that Ann Nesby and Shirley Caesar are singing together?
You about to mash I do not remember.
Ridiculous.
That. Now, if I was to tell you now, we watched that on the tour bus. If that joint was
I. Yo, I got so wait. Since we fast forwarded, can I get the whole story to Let Freedom Ring? From the song to the video to can I get some Let Freedom Ring story? Can I?
Absolutely. Well, let me see. Oh, okay. I was on a sabbatical. I think I'd gotten sick and then I was, you know, just taking time off. And I was watching TV and I saw the NAACP awards and they were honoring Dr. Dorothy Height.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness, who is that lady? I want to meet her. So I found out how to get in touch with her and I called her. And she said, why don't you come out with us in the Black family reunions that we do.
That's my dad has a picture of you and Dorothy Height. My dad's a photographer in D.C. He has a picture of y'all two at that Black family reunion.
So you know I'm not lying, right?
You're not lying. I was there too. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was little.
Right.
How were you like at the time?
I mean, I was, you know, like one.
Six.
Seven.
Okay.
Eight.
Okay. Right. Okay.
Don't worry. She was younger than me.
Wink.
So I'm sorry. I started to travel with Dr. Height and go to the breakfasts, and you know, we had people like Maxine Waters and you know, Alexis Herman and
Herman. Wow.
I mean, I met Coretta Scott King.
That was at the Black family reunion. The Jacksons came through. Hey, this is crazy. I remember, yes.
That's where I first met
Silvers,
the Clark sisters.
Oh wow! Okay,
who are on Let Freedom Ring? Right. Okay, you're telling the story. Right.
Well, they're on that, but they was performing at one of the family reunions. I said, "Oh my God, who was that?" That's how it was. It was so exciting. She says, "Well, Melba, you should sing something at our breakfast meetings or some of our meetings. Why don't you sing the Negro National Anthem?" But I didn't know we had one.
It out. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead, more.
Wow.
I found out about it, and I was with Capitol Records at the time. So I went to our A&R person, and who was with the label at the same time was BB and CC Winans.
Yes, ma'am.
It was time that a gospel artist was on a regular label. And he went and got BB Winans for me.
Mm.
And BB got everybody else.
BB got everybody else from Dion to, I'm trying to remember, Take Six.
Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
Howard Hewitt, Bobby Brown.
Like that was,
Bobby Brown?
Yes, and he was the green
girlfriend
screen.
Girlfriend era Bobby Brown.
Because obviously Bobby didn't make it to the day of shooting. He was the one of the only ones with a green screen. Right, Mel? I'm guessing, right, Melba?
How did you
I don't know. I wasn't there when they did, you know, a lot of it.
No, I'm talking about the video.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Bobby was on the green screen.
I can't remember. Oh, Take Six? They have a new version. Just got a Grammy nomination for the recent recording of the
Really? Day.
I think so.
And who was the decision? Because I know that Jasmine Guy is dope in her Alvin Ailey history, but who made the decision to have her dancing in the video? And
probably Debbie Allen,
right? Because did she direct the video?
She directed. It was her concept, and she directed it. And I'm trying to think. Well, I think Debbie was my understudy in Pearly. Oh, she was one of the lead dancers. You know, wow. She was dancing with George Faison.
Right, because she did the Wiz.
Before, she went did all those other wonderful things later on.
Wow. Yeah. So
that was her concept. And we had Lou Gossett do the narration, but on the audio version, it was Jesse Jackson.
Oh, man. Okay.
Oh, okay.
And we got permission from the NAACP. So we didn't want it to be a money thing. We wanted to donate all the funds to NAACP. And it was my idea to have all of the different celebrities, because I figured if I didn't know that we had a Negro national anthem, other people wouldn't know. They would think it was my hit record. So it was my idea to have.
And I did. And I may have done that.
Oh, yeah. That's Melba's hit record.
Yeah. I thought it was Left Free to Ring. I was like, that's not the way to. Yeah.
Right. So, okay, before I wrap, I got to know, I mean, because I have a lot of them. I mean, I could say Fallen or just a little bit more, Love Coming At You. But of your songs, of your arsenal, what songs are your personal favorites?
Well, I don't have personal favorites. I have favorites that people like. And their two favorites seem to be Love's Coming At You and Lean On Me. Mm-hmm.
Even to this, so when you perform that to this day, are you still as intense when you're performing it?
Yeah, because maybe it's because I'm still not really trained in a certain way. If I don't really focus and get everything out, I still get so scared.
To this day?
Yeah, no, it never goes away. It's like, I guess it's
that's a good thing. That means you still care.
That's a sign of respect for the audience.
I think so, because you stop and you focus. You know, what am I doing today? This is not the same show you did before. Is my throat okay? Because this is not something that's just naturally okay. I have to take care of it. So I have to make sure everything is, like I said, I could give you a run for your money for whoever is the fattest person you've ever seen if I didn't watch it. So I got to make sure I can still get them a clothes. I got to think, you know? Yeah.
Wait, I was going to ask, like, have you ever been in a situation where you were hoarse one night or unable to kind of had to slide under the slide under the bar? Like, y'all sing it. So you just Bobby Brown him. Y'all sing it. Okay, I see.
No, but so many times I haven't had background singers. There's nobody to lean on.
So then what do you do?
You make sure you're ready, but that's why you get scared beforehand. Yeah. Now I know I'm going to get scared, so I try to prepare.
Yeah, I assure you that her audience would just sing the ad-libs verbatim.
Before we go, can I ask, boss, because it's funny, we were talking about COVID and stuff, and I'm just curious, as for fans and stuff, we see you on D Nice's show, we see you all around, how can people continue to like support you? I see you got a little poster back there that your daughter might want you to shout out, but I mean, for folks who just want to support, since we can't come see you.
Oh, she told me where I am. I'm Instagram.
He told me where I am.
I'm Instagram at Melba One More.
I'm going to it right now.
Okay. And the website is melbamore.com. Am I anywhere else, honey?
I love this.
And what's your daughter's name?
Charlie. C-H-A-R-L-I. Charlie.
Shout out to Charlie.
Shout out, baby girl.
Hey.
shout out. I gotta say that this is definitely one of the silver linings of the COVID era.
Yeah.
Because when I first saw you on the scroll, I was like, there's no way that that's actually Melba Moore. No way possible.
What's the scroll?
Oh, I'm sorry. The scroll. When I'm DJing and I can see who's in the room.
In the comments.
And you get the comments and I'm like, oh my goodness. Thank you. Yeah, I'm just, you know, this is one of the few bright spots of 2020, which, you know, I can have a conversation and link up with my childhood heroes. And you're definitely a hero. And I thank you for sharing your story with us on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for everything that you've contributed. Like, just seriously.
Yes. Absolutely.
Flowers.
Yes.
I'll say, you know, I've heard about you, Quest. And I was very, very much intimidated because you are a walking encyclopedia.
And no, I'm just a fan.
But fortunately, you decided to come on my lane, you know, let me be comfortable. And I really thank you for that because you could really take it somewhere else. I've seen you play the drums.
Yeah, I play a little something. I do a little something.
A little rim shot in there.
Yes, you do.
I do a little something. all thanks to you, and I appreciate it. This is one for the books, ladies and gentlemen. Melba Moore on Questlove Supreme on behalf of Fontigolo, Sugar Steve, and say goodbye, Sugar Steve.
Thank you, Melba. I have your 1971 album.
Look at God.
There you go. He doesn't say much, but you know, it always counts. Laia and Unplayed Bill, this is the Team Supreme, and we will see you on the next go round of Questlove Supreme. Thank you.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. All right? Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.